All right, let me know when I should start.
Now.
Okay, good. So we're talking about Hafkar She'arim, really price manipulation, excessive profiteering, hoarding, price gouging, all of these types of offenses when it comes to market practice and regulation. There's a general tension as to what's a better type of economy, whether you have a free market economy in which there's very little governmental. When you have very little governmental interference, so that's called sort of a free market economy. That's what's favored, certainly, by most people in capitalistic societies. And then you have a command economy. Command economy means that you have a government that provides very strict controls and the like. As with other types of extreme or absolutist models, halacha is more nuanced. Halacha has elements of both. There's a lot of free enterprise and free market features that go into a halachic economic society, but there's also a certain amount of supervision that's necessary in order to prevent abuses in the marketplace. And that tension as to how much of supervision you need to have is actually very much in the sugya in Baba Basra, starting in Peites Amud Aleph, carrying on to Tzadi Aleph Amud Aleph, whether you mamidin agadimin lemidos alone or even mamidin agadimin l'sha'arim, or do you just have supervision when it comes to weights and measures, or do you also have supervision when it comes to sha'arim, when it comes to prices and price control, and the general feeling both that the Shmuel has in the Gemara in Baba Basra and the Rav had in the Yerushalmi, Baba Basra, was that you can trust the free market system to do its job, because eventually the consumers themselves, the lochin, will regulate the marketplace. Like the Rashbam writes on the original statement in the Gemara, "Ein ma'amidan agadimin l'sharim svaru hudeinu tzarchim zeh rotzim kobi yoker oso atzarchim os yitain bezol v'yokol lochin etzlovim kor zeh bezol al kocho." That the market forces will play out so that if it's possible to sell more cheaply, so somebody will take advantage of the ability to make a profit by selling more cheaply if the market forces allow it, then the consumers will flock to that person and will drive down the prices. But the Gemara comes to the conclusion that no, ma'amidin agadimin bein lemidos bein l'sha'arim, this is the halacha in Shulchan Aruch, Siman Reish Lamed Aleph, that we establish governmental supervision, both with respect to Bezdin supervision, both with respect to Midos and with respect to Sha'arim, because we're worried about the Ramayin, worried about those people who will manipulate market forces through hoarding, for example, hoarding produce, therefore artificially inflating prices and the like, unless we do have a more of a market supervision. What's interesting is that we read about the notion of hoarding, price hoarding, product hoarding, in Parshas Miketz already, but the person who would seem to be the offender, we know is a good guy, and that's Yosef HaTzadik. Yosef stores up all of the produce of Mitzrayim during the years of plenty. Yosef stores the produce in the warehouses so that it will be available during the famine, and then he's in charge of dispersing the produce, and this continues on. This next week's Parsha, Parshas Vayigash, we see how there is a dependency upon Yosef, so much so that the government ends up taking over the land of the people. They're all the more happy to do so as long as they can be fed, because the one most important thing that a government has to ensure is that the people don't starve. So they get the food and they're fed and they're happy, it seems, from the psukim, that they're happy to be sharecroppers under these circumstances. So it's interesting. The Shiltas Rav Achai Gon, which I have towards the end of the sources, uses this opportunity to devote the entire commentary in Parshas Vayigash to write about these prohibitions that we're discussing of Hafkar She'arim, of Otzrei Naperos, of hoarding and price gouging, and specifically speaks about the Shnas Betzoris, which is what's discussed in Parshas Miketz, Parshas Vayigash, times of famine, when the prohibition, at least regarding the prohibition of hoarding produce, is more severe. A person normally is allowed to keep whatever produce that grows in their own field for as long a period of time as they feel that they would like to store the produce for the future. But if it's a time of famine, then they're restricted to 1 year's worth of time, the way that we paskin la halacha, the way that it's described even in the commentary of the Rashbam in the Baba Basra, Yeshaya la'atzmo k'dei ha'tza'aso l'shana. Shas b'tzoris, so you get 1 year's worth, and that's the way that it's paskin la halacha in Shulchan Aruch. And the Gemara says that during a time of famine, while generally speaking, when the prohibition of hoarding applies to things that are chayei nefesh, that are necessary foodstuffs, the way that Rabbi Aaron Levine puts it, those things which are absolute staples. But when it comes to things that are not staples, so then it would be okay to hoard. You want to hold on with the stamps, comic books, things that are not staples. That's okay. Even spices and the like. However, the Gemara says during a time of famine, afilu kav charuvin. Even when you're dealing with carobs, carobs also are not allowed to be stored during that period of time. The Shultos takes that to mean that during a time of famine, you're not even allowed to hold on to items that are not chayei nefesh. There are a number of different nuanced machlokas in between the Shultos and the Netziv in his commentary on the Shultos Eimek Shela. This is one of them. The Netziv simply says, no. When the Gemara says, afilu kav charuvin, are not allowed to afilu kav charuvin lo yetzor during a shnasa b'tzoris. So what the Gemara means is that we expand the definition of necessary items of what's considered to be chayei nefesh during shnas b'tzoris. If you have very little to subsist upon, so you live like Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa, who is able to subsist on a kav charuvin, me'erev Shabbos le'erev Shabbos, so that becomes the norm during times of famine, says the Netziv. It's not that we no longer have the chayei nefesh standards, that we redefine chayei nefesh. One of the major points of discussion amongst contemporary poskim when it comes to this whole issue of the issue of hoarding and price the fixing and regulate and price regulation, which we also generally assume only applies to chayei nefesh or things which are borderline chayei nefesh, is how in the contemporary economic world do we define that which is a chayei nefesh? What are the necessary items? Is it only necessary foodstuff, or do we perhaps even expand beyond necessary foodstuff? And we'll get to that. We'll get to that. So in any event, this is the Shultos when he speaks about Shnas B'tzoris. So it becomes an interesting question. Why did the Shultos seize upon this? So one could see, or could say, or that there's perhaps it's all just a lead-in, that the Shultos looks for halachic topics that can relate maybe only even tangentially to the parasha in question. And once you're on the subject of Shnas B'tzoris, so he mentions as well, oh yeah, I'll tell you something else about Shnas B'tzoris, which is also V'adim L'shamesh Mitasu B'Shnas B'tzoris, and that's the only place where he explicitly mentions Yosef HaTzadik, because Yosef did not procreate during the Shnas B'tzoris, because it was a time of famine, it was a time of tsar. Yosef Yulad Shnei Bonim B'Terem Tavo Shnas Arav. It was only before the Shnas B'tzoris. However, the pasuk in question happens to be in Parshas Miketz, not in Parshas of Vayigash, so it would seem possible that still the overall subject matter of the Shultos and speaking about hoarding and speaking about price regulation was really inspired by the general situation that is still being described in Parshas of Vayigash, of the idea of Bezdin or governmental regulatory measures. What are the appropriate parameters for governmental regulatory measures? So if you look at the totality of the sugya in Baba Basra over these two blot from Pei Tes to Tzadi Aleph, I tried to include in source at number one sort of the major parts of the sugya from the beginning when we speak about the parameters of Bezdin or governmental regulation all the way to the end of the sugya. We see that there are basically four isurim. There are basically four different prohibitions that are mentioned, and there is a sort of one affirmative measure which is mentioned. The four isurim that are mentioned are number one, hafkas she'arim. Hafkas she'arim is excessive profiteering, when there is a manipulation of the market in order to distort prices. Now, price distortion, we see at the beginning of the sugya, really means a price distortion in the sense that there is excessive increase in prices. But at the end of the sugya, when we speak about masri and al pragmatia of a filu b'shabbes, you see, price distortion could also go in the opposite direction, that you could have underpricing where the merchants are going to be driven out of making a living because the prices are too low. So it really could go in both directions. Number two, we have otzrei peros. We have the prohibition against hoarding. And number three, we have the prohibition not to be motzi peros. That you're not allowed to export peros, export produce outside of Eretz Yisrael. So that this way you're depriving the inhabitants, the citizens, from having all of the requisite produce. And number four, we have a notion of mishtakrim be'eretz Yisrael b'dvar m'sheyesh b'em chayei nefesh. It's interesting because mishtakrim takes on different meanings at the beginning of the sugya and the end of the sugya. The beginning of the sugya, mishtakrim ayishtakrim yotim mishtusu, which is Shmuel's dictum, that you're not allowed to engage in excessive profiteering. You shouldn't have more than a 1/6 profit. That's how the sugya begins. When the sugya ends with the mishtakrim, Eretz Yisrael with Ram Sheish from Chayei Nefesh, it's a different type of mishtakrim. Mishtakrim here means a prohibition of trading. You shouldn't have too many stages of middlemen. I'm sorry. You shouldn't get drunk over it either, but mistakrit, fine. That you shouldn't be mistakrit, thank you, with respect to too many different levels of trading. This is the idea of eliminate the middleman, which is sort of a popular expression when we speak about efficiencies of price of regulation, that if you have too many middlemen and the middlemen aren't doing anything other than buying and selling, but they're not improving the product in any way. They're not taking the wheat and turning it into bread or doing something else with it. They're just therefore driving up the prices because each step of those who are the brokers of the product are going to end up driving up the price because each one needs to make their own personal, with their own personal profit. Now, each one of these four categories are qualified as referring to chayei nefesh. The Gemara says that they all refer only to items. You're not allowed to hoard items that are chayei nefesh. You're not allowed to export items that are chayei nefesh. You're not allowed to trade in items which are chayei nefesh. The only one that does not explicitly say in the Gemara anyway that it's restricted to the chayei nefesh is with respect to Shmuel's dictum of Havkar Sharim. Of Amosipin Alamidos Yotir Mishtus of Amistakir Ayistakir Yotir Mishtus. So Shmuel doesn't say that this is limited to Chayei Nefesh. He doesn't say that explicitly. However, the Rambam, when he qualifies the halacha, he says explicitly that it is related only, even this particular rule and regulation is related only to Chayei Nefesh. That's the Rambam in Hilchos Mechira Perek Yudalid. And he says that lo yisakir mocher yeter al shtus b'medrim amurim b'dvarim sheyesh b'hem chayei nefesh kegon yeinu shmonim muslosos. Only those things which are necessary foodstuffs. And the Magen Mishnah says that this is number one related to the fact that a mistakrin is sort of put together with the issue of hoarding, that you're not supposed to hoard because it's going to drive up prices in the market. And the Gemara says that hoarding is restricted in Otsrim Peros Dvarim Sheish Bim Chayei Nefesh, is restricted to Chayei Nefesh. And furthermore, the Gemara explicitly speaks about Emistakmim Pamayim Bebeitzim, that you're not allowed to make a double profit with respect to Beitzim. That means that what? You are allowed to make up to a double profit when it comes to Beitzim, meaning that you can make more than a 1/6 profit. What's a 1/6 profit? It's 20%. It means when all is said and done, 1/6 you're going to make a 1/6 profit after you take the 20% from the original principal. So the profit that you can make is basically 20%. Well, if you're making, you're allowed to make a 99% profit with respect to Beitzim, obviously you're making more than that. So Amistrakim Pamayim Beitzim, it's a machlokus between Rav and Shmuel, what it means. One says it means that you can't make more than 99% profit. And the other one says that, no, when it comes to Beitzim, we don't allow you to have more than one level of the person who's collecting the eggs from the private farmers. And then he's allowed to sell it, but he's not allowed to have a tagra latagra. You're not allowed to have another layer of trading because it's going to drive up the prices to a degree which will be unfair to the consumer, since there already is going to be a markup from the person who's collecting the eggs because he has to go door to door collecting so many different eggs. So therefore, there's already a tircha premium that's going to be placed on the eggs to begin with. So it says the Magen Mishnah that since Shmuel is the one that said that you're not allowed to make more than a 1/6 profit, so we should have said to Stayim that the one who says that when you're not allowed to make a double profit when it comes to Beitzim is not Shmuel. Shmuel must be the one who just says you can't have a second layer of middlemen, because Shmuel would hope, forget about a double profit, you're not allowed to make more than a 1/6 profit. Rather, we see there's a distinction between Beitzim and other items, because Beitzim clearly is not considered to be Chayei Nefesh, that only with respect to Chayei Nefesh did Shmuel articulate his din. The Kesef Mishnah disagrees with the Magen Mishnah only insofar as the Magen Mishnah seems to say that within the class of food items, you have some food items that are Chayei Nefesh and some food items that are not Chayei Nefesh, and the Kesef Mishnah says nothing doing. All food items are Chayei Nefesh. The only things that are not Chayei Nefesh are things that are like spices, things of that variety. But if it's a main food item that you actually eat, so of course even eggs would be considered to be Chayei Nefesh. But despite the fact that they have sort of that sidebar machlokis, one thing that the Kesef Mishnah does not disagree with the Magen Mishnah about, and this is reflected certainly in the Psak, in the Mechaber, in the Shulchan Aruch as well, is the notion that this prohibition of not charging and not profiting more than 1/6 on the original principle that was invested in Chayei Nefesh, however Chayei Nefesh is defined, that this is restricted only to Chayei Nefesh. The Kesef Mishnah doesn't disagree with the Magen Mishnah that this restriction on profiting more than 1/6 on whatever it is, that it has to be in the category of Chayei Nefesh. So we see that all four of these would relate to Chayei Nefesh. There is, with respect to the prohibition of profiteering more than 1/6, so we do have three different levels, basically, of what's allowed. If it's Chayei Nefesh, you can't profit more than 1/6. If it's completely outside of the realm of food altogether, it's just some type of rarefied spice, so then you can make even a 500% of profit. It's a luxury item. Luxury item. So who told people that they need to have luxury items? You want a luxury item. So go ahead, you know, pay a 500% you know, more than whatever the person invested if you really want the luxury item so badly. We're not going to regulate luxury items to make sure that everybody will be able to afford luxury items. And then there's sort of an intermediate category. An intermediate category of things that are like machshirei ochel nefesh, things that are like tavlin, their relishes and those and toppings and those types of things that would accompany food, but not the main part of food. And within this category, the Magen Mishnah clearly feels that there are even some foods that are not such necessary foodstuffs, or they're not considered to be staples as much. Eggs, okay, so you'll have an occasional egg, but it's not a staple the same way that oil and flour and wine, at least in the olden days, wine was something that used to just flow much more freely, that people would drink their wine every single day. That was considered to be much more of a staple, but you can have lots of foodstuffs that are sort of in this intermediate category. The intermediate category would be subjected to the al-chatrei exception, that you would be allowed to make a profit up until 100%, but not more than that. But we also find that a lot of these halachos, and this is very relevant in terms of how much we're going to apply this to New York, how much we're going to apply it to Chicago, places outside of Eretz Yisrael, are these dinim specific to Eretz Yisrael? Is there something that we say, okay, this is nice that for Achenu Kobeis Yisrael in Eretz Yisrael, so it's important they need to be mindful of how to apply these halachos, but they don't necessarily apply to chutzlars. We see a lot of mention of Eretz Yisrael with respect to these halachos, particularly the last two halachos, with respect to Ein Motzi'in Peiros Me'eretz Yisrael, Ein Mistaklin Be'eretz Yisrael, Dvarim She'esh Bahem Chayei Nefesh. The last two categories mention Eretz Yisrael. The first two categories do not mention Eretz Yisrael, but don't worry, the second category of Otzrei Peiros, somebody slipped in Eretz Yisrael somewhere. When an Eretz Yisrael gets slipped in, I don't know. It made it. You look in the halach and Shulchan Aruch, the hoarding prohibition, yeah, that applies to Eretz Yisrael. The Shultos already says, yeah, it applies to Eretz Yisrael. So the Netziv is very nice giving you the Maran Mekomos. The Netziv says, you want to know where the Shiltos got it from, that the hoarding prohibition applies to Eretz Yisrael. He got it from the Tosefta Maseches Avodah Zarah, Perek Dalet, actually records this prohibition, and the Tosefta says Eretz Yisrael. So that made it into the halacha, but as the Rashbam says, v'nira li to be ir she ruba Yisrael mayri. He says, we're talking about any city which has a majority of Jews, and that's well, it's generally understood, the halacha, the Sman, Shulchan Aruch as well, codifies this halacha that the prohibition of hoarding applies in any single place where the Jews basically run the market. So if you live in a place in Chutz La'aretz, which is mostly non-Jewish, so the non-Jews are going to hoard this, so it wouldn't be fair to impose discrimination upon the Jewish merchants. What are you going to do? But if you're either dealing with a product, which is exclusively a Jewish product, or you're dealing like for ritual items, for example, like a esrogim around the Sukkot time or whatever, or you're dealing with some type of a community like Lakewood or Muncie, where it's a majority of Jews who live in the community. I'm not sure if West Rogers Park qualifies or not to where I live, but certainly there are plenty of communities nowadays where this would be applicable. So then the prohibition, it says the SMAP, would go into place. What about in terms of not exporting items? So so there the SMA says, it's either based upon the idea of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. If it's based on Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, we want all the good stuff to stay in Eretz Yisrael. The one exception was we're going to allow wine. We're going to allow wine to be exported. Why is that? Because we don't want people to get too drunk. Look, you know, I'm already running with Mishtaklin. So it's better, you know, that we're going to get rid of the wine. That's okay if it's the marijuana. You can export that stuff. But in terms of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, the good stuff should stay within Eretz Yisrael. But however, it's interesting, the SMA also says, and this is a kind of, you have to wonder, because the Rashbam in the Sugya does not have this qualification when it comes to the exportation law. He says, maybe it's simply because the assumption is that it's very rare to have an Ir Sherubo Yisrael in Chutz La'aretz, but if you did have an Ir Sherubo Yisrael, so then you really shouldn't export items outside of that area either. It's interesting. I don't know anyone other than the SMA who sort of mentions that as an aside, but it's important to know the SMA does mention that. With respect to the idea of the prohibition of the multiple levels of a trade, so the Aruch HaShulchan says, look, we have in the Sugya, it says that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah would engage in multiple levels of trading when it came to oil and wine. So wine, clearly, he's happy to restrict the availability of wine so people will not become drunk as much. And with respect to oil, it's because there was plenty of oil where he happened to live. So it's plenty of oil, so you don't have to worry so much about the driving up the prices since there's so much oil. So then you're going to have a situation like the Rashbam mentioned in the Havamina of the Gemara with Eima Amidin Agadim and Lesharim, that if you have so much of a product, then somebody's going to take advantage of the ability that there's enough available of the product that they'll sell it. They'll figure out how to sell it for a lower cost by simply reducing the amount of trading, the amount of middlemen who are involved, and the market will sort of fix itself. So says the Aruch HaShulchan that with respect to most products, including, again, and we're speaking about Chayei Nefesh here, that in Chutz La'aretz, there's just a much bigger yield. It's a much bigger area. There are many more granaries. There are many more olive presses. There are many more cornfields. And therefore, there's going to be a much greater yield. So that itself, just like in the case of oil, will fix the problem when you're dealing with multiple levels of trading. So therefore, that's why in Chutz La'aretz, it would not need to be regulated. It's interesting because even with respect to exportation, all of this and none of it is sort of set in stone. We're not talking about Xeris Akosov over here. We're talking about economic regulation for the purpose of the Chayei Nefesh of the society. So it really depends upon circumstances. You look at Rav Ezra Batsri in his Sefer Dinei Mamonos, source 18, Ha'ara 9, so he says that Hadava Baror, that nowadays when you are transporting, you're exporting items in Chutz La'aretz outside of Eretz Yisrael, You're not doing it to take away from Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. You're doing it in order to improve the economy. The items that you're able to export, you're able to sell and so forth. So that's good for the economy of Eretz Yisrael. So he says that since it's better for all of the residents of Israel that you have a very strong, thriving, robust exportation business, so therefore this halacha, he didn't record this halacha, even though he's writing about Eretz Yisrael, about some sort of an issue of exportation nowadays, because he says, shekol shenaseh, and he quotes in the Mishpat Shalom, who writes this with respect to exporting esrogim and wine and sfarim from Eretz Yisrael. We probably could use a little bit more exportation of their sfarim from Eretz Yisrael while we're at it. Says shekol shenaseh, the chizik hayishu ba'aretz mutter. Anything which is going to be stronger for the economic viability and well-being of the land, so that's going to be mutter, so it's going to be very contextual. And as we'll see, as we go along, all of these things are going to be very much dependent upon circumstances. So those are the four different areas of prohibition, and there's one affirmative obligation. Yes? I think here it was intuitive and understood that all of these regulations were for their economic benefit. That it was not simply that these were done in a vacuum. They wouldn't make any sense whatsoever. They would, in fact, be counterproductive if they went against the sort of the purpose of the takana. These are too essential, because here we're talking about the things that go to people's lifeblood. We're talking about what's going to sustain. That's why all of these things are regular. All of these things are restricted to chayei nefesh, because we're talking about what's going to enable people to live. So this is all about living. You don't play around and say, oh, you know, once we have a takana, it's a davar shebeminyan, we're not messing with it. It's the whole purpose of these things is for chayei, is v'chei achicha imach. It's not as essential. None of that is quite in the same category as chai nefesh. I don't think so. Also, you could say that this is the sort of thing where this is part of the articulation of the tokan itself. Remember, you had this tremendous tension whether you're going to have the price regulation with respect to sharim, and it caused tremendous amount of tension. But the Reish Galusa in Yerushalmi, the Baba Basra, wanted Rav very much to do the regulation. This was a big philosophical argument about what type of economy is going to be good for the people. And Rav said, I'm not regulating the prices. And the Reish Galusa threw him into prison. He threw him into jail. That's how serious it was. Why did it get that heated? You're going to throw Rav into jail? Because you're dealing with the fundamental question, what's going to cause people, which type of approach is going to enable people to live or die, have the necessities in life or not? So this very much really depends upon the second part of the equation. What accomplishes the right result? What doesn't accomplish the right result? So this is the affirmative obligation. The affirmative obligation is that Beis Din has to regulate the prices. It caused a lot of debate, but ultimately the Gemara says we have to worry about two different levels of Ramayin. We have to worry about Ramayin. The Rashbam tells us one type of Ramayin is that you will have an artificial inflation of the prices in the market because people are going to hoard the supply and they're going to create an artificial shortage. The merchants will create an artificial shortage, and therefore you need the regulation so that the shortage is not going to be created. In order for them to drive up the prices, that you say, no, you can't sell for more than a certain price, and therefore that's going to require them to keep the prices and the goods available so that they'll be able to justify the prices that they're not allowed to charge beyond that price. And so it's not going to pay for them to hoard the merchandise. And number two, says the Rashbam, that it is also Ramayin who are going to potentially mislead the public about the value of the merchandise altogether. They'll pretend that the merchandise is worth a lot more. They'll dress it up, or they'll get people to buy too much of it than is really needed. They'll sell shampoo, and they'll say lather, rinse, repeat. They'll add the word repeat. As we know, that drove up shampoo prices, you know, doubled, that enabled a 100% profit in the market, because that's in the days when people would actually read the instructions and follow it. I don't think that we have that type of consumer base anymore. But once upon a time, so people followed instructions. So they would rinse, repeat. So they needed twice as much shampoo. So you need a regulation of the market so that you're not going to misrepresent the products and cause people to spend too much for too little. So now let's go back to the sugya of Yosef Atzadik and the Shiltos that focuses on these halachos in Parshas Vayigash. Obviously, Yosef Atzadik was not going to violate these various issues. So what is it then? If we look upon his behavior of hoarding, so why was that not problematic? So you could say, well, he wasn't an Eretz Yisrael, and it wasn't an Ir Sherubo Yisrael where he was, but we assume that since Yosef was in charge of implementing the economy in Mitzrayim, he would have implemented the economy according to his own value system. So I saw two different explanations, one in a journal called Arachim, from the Olamot site, which quotes from the German economist Sigmund Frankl. I don't know who this Sigmund Frankl was. I can tell you he seemed to be a Talmid Chacham because he quotes some Midrashim to explain how Yosef HaTzadik really was following all of these economic principles. If you look very closely at the way that Yosef conducted himself, he says that, first of all, the pasuk says, "Vayiftach Yosef es kol asher behem." The Yosef, even before he dispersed all the food, he opened up the warehouses, and he said that was in order to prevent some sort of a panic within the marketplace. Because one of the things that the hoarders do is they create a panic that people are afraid that there isn't a sufficient supply, so they're going to pay more. So Yosef showed, don't panic, because there's plenty here, even though we're going to store it, and look, I have all of these warehouses available. And then if you look in the Medrash in Parshas Vayikates, on Parshas Mikates, where it says, Yosef Ku HaShalit Al HaAretz, that Yosef HaTzadik actually acted not as a player in terms of being a merchant who was hoarding, but he was amongst the Mefakhin. He was serving as the governmental authority, basically fulfilling the affirmative obligation to prevent shortage, to prevent hoarding, and to prevent panic. But Haigon has a number of principles in his Sefer Mecha Chumemka Shar Samech, where he says that one of the things that is very important not to violate is Shalom Yehi Mafchid B'nei Ha'adam Be'amo Tzvua Mu'etis Ba'olam, that you shouldn't frighten people into saying, oh, there's hardly any grain around, and then there's going to be a panic like the Great Depression. You're not allowed to scream famine in a crowded country. So this is a general, you know, fundamental principle of Rav Haigon, that you have to prevent Bahala, and this is exactly what Yosef HaTzadik did. If you look at, number one, the fact that he opened up the warehouses to prevent the Bahala, and the Medrash even commends Yosef HaTzadik, contrasting him with Paro, a little bit of a question, which Paro was he being contrasted with in terms of his following these principles? The Medrash says, Monea bar yikvu lahom, ubracha l'rosh mashbir, suppose it can mishle. Monea bar yikvu lahom, that a person who deprives the citizenry of food is going to be cursed nationally. Zeh Paro. This is Paro according to the Eitz Yosef. It's not the Paro in the days of Yosef, in the days of Yosef HaTzadik. That Paro just deferred to Yosef HaTzadik to enact economic policy. Didn't do anything wrong. We're talking about the Paro in the days of Avraham and Yitzchak. There was a famine in their land, so those Paros said, I'm going to keep all the good stuff to myself, and I'm going to hoard the merchandise, and I'm going to charge everybody a hand and a foot in order for them to buy any of the merchandise. Zeparo, the kachi gvu laom, v'yubrios mekaloso, so al shigonez es sadvua b'shnasri yovon. This is what Paro did. Paro, that Paro, the earlier Paro, essentially hoarded and deprived the people of the produce during times of famine. As opposed to Yosef HaTzadik, who took care of the people. He had proper supervisory responsibility that he exercised, as the viceroy of the land. According to the Medrash Rabba, this is something that apparently the Sigmund Frankel focused upon. The Medrash Rabba speaks about three different takanos. The three different takanos, the way that most of the Meforshei Medrash explain what takanos Yosef HaTzadik enacted in order to get his brothers to come and not to send messengers and not to have some other excuse as to why they wouldn't come themselves. But he explains that they were also forms of good economic regulation. Number one, Shlo Yikanes Eved LeMitzrayim. This one was the biggest stretch. Said they could say you wouldn't allow an Eved LeMitzrayim that was keeping out the elements that would drain the economy. An Eved that doesn't really have much training, that doesn't have work skills, that's just going to become a charge upon the land during a time of famine. So he kept out those unproductive elements. Number two, Shlo Yikanes Adam Mishnei Chamorim. He wouldn't allow people when they're coming to buy their land to come with two donkeys. Why couldn't they come with two donkeys? Because then they might take too much and they would be taking a certain amount of produce for themselves. And then with the other donkey, they would load the other donkey for purposes of taking a certain amount of the produce that's not going to be eaten right away. They're going to hoard themselves, and then they're going to create a black market. It's going to create a black market in order to charge inflated prices, basically with the amount that they've taken off the market to sell to others. And number three, v'shelo yoliku tfua mimakom lemakom, that the tfua, the grain, shouldn't be taken from one place to another place. There'd be one central place in which all of the grain would be sold from, so the Yosef could better regulate the prices if they'd be moved from place to place. So in those big cities where there would be more of a demand, that's going to drive up the prices of anything that would be transported to those other locations. In this way, he was able to prevent any of those abuses. So that's one explanation as to how Yosef was sort of a model of this proper regulation and preventing these types of abuses. Another explanation I saw in the very first volume of Tchumen, that the Tchumen journal is a very, very interesting journal in Eretz Yisrael, because it was really devised by the Tzomet Institute for purposes of relating halacha to the modern state of Israel, going through sugyos and the Gemara, going through the halachos, figuring out how are we going to apply all of these halachos in a modern Jewish state in Israel. A very, very beautiful goal that they've really actualized through Rabbi Saul Rosen, really actualized in a very, very beautiful fashion over the years. So in the very first issue, Rabbi Tama Warhaftig, a big Mishpat Ivri scholar in Talmud Chacham. I think I've spoken with him at a few of these Dayonis conferences of Halichos Am Yisrael over the years. He wrote an article about Mahavkar Sharim. He wrote an article about these types of issues. And he wrote that what Yosef Asadi did was really a fulfillment of the exception that's mentioned that Mutar La'adam in the Gemara, Mutar La'adam Le'atzor Peres Beretz Yisrael Gimel Shanim. Sometimes a little bit of hoarding is allowed when you know that you're going to have a year of famine, when you know the Shemitah year is about to arrive. So then, Erev Shviyos, Shviyos, and Motzei Shviyos, you're allowed to preserve and store items for that three-year period in order to prevent starvation. So basically, that's what Yosef HaTzadik did. And by storing the items, even during the years of plenty, he actually took items off of the market when people had enough, so that they wouldn't have a glut of items, which it wasn't necessary to drive down prices so much when there would be such a glut. So he enabled like small incremental price increases during that time that simply standardized and normalized the price to what it really should be. You would have the right amount of goods on the market. And then as the various goods became more and more depleted during the time of famine, and he was able, with whatever he had continued to store during that time, to see to it that the price increments would not be abrupt and they would not be extreme, but they would be manageable. And this also prevented a sense of behola, and the more that you can prevent behola, so paigon, right? So that also is going to, by virtue of preventing panic, that's going to also keep prices stable and enable people to subside much more easily. Now, there's another major curiosity with respect to all these halakhas, and it's an obvious question. It's an obvious question. I don't want you all to jump at me because it's an obvious answer. So you're all going to jump at me the obvious answer. But don't worry, I'll give you the obvious answer. If you have a more obvious answer, you can give me the more obvious answer. But it's an obvious question. So I'm going to simply raise the question, and then I'm going to amplify the question while you're, you know, waiting for me to give the obvious answer. And then I'm going to give the obvious answer, if that's okay. But I'll try to do it quickly. So that is the idea that the Shmuel made this enactment. You're not allowed to profiteer more than 1/6, right? And the Sma has these three gradations that he says that if it's not chayei nefesh, you can, but it's makshiri yakel ochel nefesh, you can make 100% profit. And if it's something which is completely outside of the realm of food altogether, so then you're allowed to make, in fact, if you look at the Sma, that's source 17, Sifkaton Lamidvav. So he says something which is not chayei, something which is makshiri yakel nefesh. He gives the example of cumin, kamun, metavlin, and relish. And if the things which are not ochel nefesh at all, like kosher de lavona, various nice fancy spices, you could even make 400% profit, kiflei kiflayim, mea keren, and presumably more than that as well. So what happened to the Yisrona? What's going on over here? First of all, up until 1/6, you're allowed to make. Who says that when it comes to onah, that even though we only require money to be given back when it's a 1/6 onah and the transaction to be void if it's more than 1/6, but even if it's less than 1/6, the Ramban al Chumash indicates it's also one day, and the Rosh indicates that it's still usher. So why is it that even with chayei nefesh, you're allowed to profit up to 1/6? And number two, when it's not chayei nefesh, you can profit 100%, you can profit 500%. What happened to Lo Sonu Isha Sachid? How could such a thing be? So the simple, obvious answer, which you can find, it's funny because it's an obvious answer, but it would be nice if the Meforshim would like address it outright, say, oh, you're probably all asking this question, but they just assume that you understand, you get it. So nobody really spells it out so much. Some of the recent writers have focused more upon this question, said, oh yeah, this is really what the Rambam was getting at, this is what this one was getting at, that one was getting at. But the obvious answer, if you look essentially at the Aruch HaShulchan, which I have in the sources, in source 24, in Siman Reish Lamed Hey, so he says that basically, what's the idea? If you're going to raise the prices, so it's going to be a very, very expensive market price. So then that's a violation of, as we said, and the Gemara compares this with people who are malve beribis. What is the problem over here? The problem is either setting or raising the market price to begin with. Obviously, we expect every single merchant to make a profit. You can't be a merchant. You can't go into business without making a profit. When we speak about Isra Onah does not mean you can't make a profit. Of course, you can make a profit. You can make a little bit of a profit. You can make a 1/6 profit. If it's not chayei nefesh, you can make a much bigger profit. If it's makshiri yakel nefesh, okay, up to twice the amount that you put into it. If it's not chayei nefesh, you can make a 500% profit. Of course, we expect people to make a profit. But the question is, when it comes to onah means that once we have established whatever the market price is going to be, that of course is going to allow the merchant to make a profit. So then you're not allowed to charge more than the market price. You're not allowed to cheat the merchant to buy something at less than the market price. That's what onah means. Onah means once I have a market price, so then I'm not allowed to overcharge, and I'm not allowed to bilka the seller either with respect to whatever the market price is. The din of Shmuel is how do we set the market price in the first place? In terms of setting the market price, what are the amount of profits for the merchant that's going to be allowable? So we say, oh, if it's a necessary foodstuff, you're not allowed to get more than a 1/6 profit. And if it's a foodstuff that's not as necessary, okay, well, you can make more profit, but even that, not through the roof, only up to 100% if it's beitzim or something which is an equivalent category. And if it's something which is beyond that, you're selling a master grand piano, which isn't considered to be a necessary item. So then, fine, you can make a 500% profit, and we'll let the market forces sort of resolve themselves in terms of what the going price is going to be. So that's really the obvious answer. However, the question is such a good question that there are other authorities that have come up with other answers. So you don't really have to come up with other answers because that's the obvious answer. However, it's instructive to look at some of the other explanations that are given. So there are three other explanations. One explanation that I saw from a mechaber, he's the Rosh Yeshiva of Ottawa. I don't know what yeshiva that is. His name is Rabbi Eliezer ben Paras. So he says that if you look at the Rambam in a source of 14:13 over here, in Hilchos Mechira Perek Yudalet, so the Rambam says, I'll tell you one distinction between a price setting and the Isra Onah. When it comes to the Isra Onah, So he refers to no sin bemuna has a couple of different meanings in Siman Reish Kuf Zayin. When the Rambam is using this expression, it's more sort of in the realm of your case of the person who says, I'm giving you an item, I'm overcharging you for the item, I'm an ashein l'chalai unah, on the condition you're not going to have a claim of unah against me, which we say is not permissible. But if I tell the person exactly what the item is worth and exactly how much I'm overcharging him, and he says, okay, I'll pay that much anyway, that's permissible. That's okay. That's the halacha. So says the Rambam, so this is in contrast to that. When we're setting the market price for the chayei nefesh, so then we do not simply allow the merchants to say, listen, we're being honest with you, that we're charging you, more than a sixth. We're going to be making 100% profit. You don't want to buy it? All right, don't buy the milk. Don't buy the flour. Don't buy the oil. Don't buy the wine. That's okay with us. But we're leveling you. We're leveling you. We're telling you exactly how much profit we're going to make. Say, no, then it's not allowed. In this particular case, when it comes to the setting of the price, so you're not just because you're going to be open, honest, and transparent, that's not going to be permissible. You're required to set a price initially in which the profit is not going to be any more than 1/6. In this way, it's different from the Yisr Onah. The third explanation, which I saw in Wahaftig, in Dr. Wahaftig's. Well, when we're talking about the prices that are set in terms of how much profit we're going to allow the merchants to make. So it's not the same, but it's the price that we allow is based upon the profit. That's what the Gemara says. Hamistakir ayistakir yotem mishtos. This is exactly the difference between Hafkar She'arim and Onah. Hafkar She'arim is what you set the price as. You're allowed to set the price as up to a certain amount, that we allow that. And Onah is if you happen to charge more than whatever that market price is. You're right. You could, technically speaking, establish a price at which you're going to take a loss. Although, as we're going to see, that's not necessarily something which we're going to be happy about either, because we don't want the merchants to drive themselves out of business. So part of the price regulation is that we bedafka want the merchants to make a certain amount of profit. We'll get to that in a second. So we'll have to...
All I'm asking is that when the prohibition is on the higher percentages, yeah, of the smaller referencing, that might be profit, but still not a comment on prices. So it could be that you're allowed to make up to whatever it is more than your cost, which would be profit, but that does not excuse you from the prohibition of charging more than it takes off the market price.
Right, because right now we're talking about
your individual gain.
Yes.
One has to do with your excess prices.
Exactly right. We're talking about right now how we establish the market price in the first place. In other words, that's the answer. That Hafkar She'arim is all about establishing the market price in the first place. That we don't allow people to establish a market price for chayei nefesh that's going to be an excessive profit. And then once we establish the price, so that's where the Yisr Onah sets in. That's where the Yisr Onah sets in. That's exactly what we're saying.
I think we're saying this then.
Okay. Okay. No. It's all right. Maybe I'm missing something. I'm trying to understand exactly what you say. You're saying something different than that. Try again. Try again. Okay. If you feel that there's something that's being missed, please say it again. Okay. Now the Wahaftig makes a suggestion that maybe in part we're talking about even before there's a market price. And this may relate to what you're trying to say as well. Let's say that there is no market price. So he says that the Yisr Hafkar She'arim is also applicable when, if there's no market price, so it's difficult to say there's an Yisr Onah. The Yisr Onah sets in when I do have a market price, the person's not allowed, merchant's not allowed to charge more than the market price. A seller's not allowed to buy for less than the market price, unless, both parties know what the deal is and there's a waiver. However, let's say there's no market price. So then if I'm dealing with chayei nefesh, so every single person, every single merchant, who knows exactly how much cost he put into having this oil to sell, this wine to sell, the flour to sell, whatever is the necessary foodstuff, So then he has to restrict himself that he can't make more than 1/6 profit. So that's another application. That's an application when I don't have a market price to begin with. And a fourth explanation is that Hafkar Sharim, as I mentioned at the very beginning of this year, is that only that you cannot, that you can't set the market price too high, but it also means that the Bezdin has to go around to ensure that the market price is not going to be set too low. And in fact, that's the sugya in Baba Metzia, Daf Mem, with respect to Rabbi Yehuda, that Rabbi Yehuda was in the business of selling wine, and the Gemara first comes to the conclusion that he was making less than a 1/6 profit. So the Gemara asks the question, when you are making a profit, you're not allowed to make more than a sixth. So what's the problem over here? He was making much less than a sixth. So Rashi writes, Hashtus yistakir, at least a sixth let the guy make, because v'lamal yistakir v'ayud hashtus. He's a merchant, so he's entitled to get his shtus. He's entitled to get his 1/6. And Tosus says the same thing. We're angry at the merchant who's not going to make the basic amount of profit, the basic margin that he needs in order to be able to support his family, because we don't want the merchants to go out there and to be poor and to be dependent upon the public wheel and to be dependent upon welfare programs if they can sell their stuff at a reasonable price. So that also becomes the responsibility of a Bezdin. So therefore, this is also sort of the flip side of the equation of something where we are speaking about here, setting a market price where the merchant has to be responsible, and the Bezdin therefore helps the merchant be responsible to ensure that the price may not be set too low. So those are all the different explanations. Now, as I mentioned, this is compared to Malvei Beribis, and the Shiltos goes so far as to say that those who violate this idea of Hafkas Sha'arim, those who are going to excessively profiteer, are considered to be, says the Shiltos, amongst those, the Manda of Idhaki, Vahavalei Mechila Liolam. Such a person never gets forgiveness. It's a pasuk in Amos, which is quoted by the Gemara, the people who say, Masaya bo chodesh v'nashpiva shever v'ashavas v'nitzcha b'la'aktin eifel ha'agdil shek l'avis l'avis mozni mirma. Those people say, oh, I want to wait until the main season passes, and then I'm going to take the items that I hoarded, and I'm going to be able to make a huge profit off of them because of the fact that I basically inflated the prices by taking them off the market, and now I'm going to make a killing. So the Gemara says, Nishba, the Pasuk in Amos, quoted by the Gemara, says, Nishba Hashem begon Yaakov meshkach v'netzah kol maseim. Such a person, they'll forever, their items, their actions will never be forgotten. And it says the Shiltos, you know what that means? It means ein mechila li'olam. Says the Netziv, that's because it's gezel harabim. Gezel harabim, you steal from the rabim, it's very difficult to repay the rabim, to figure out every single person that you chiseled, every single person whose life you made the difficult and whose life maybe you ended up extinguishing because there were not ample supplies of a basic foodstuffs for a person to feed their family. What people don't realize, and this is such a fascinating thing, we dive in three times a day, Shmoneh Esrei. How many of us, when we say the bracha of Barech Aleinu, realize that we're talking about this issue of Hafkas Sha'arim? Most people don't even know what the words mean, Hafkas Sha'arim. Hafkas Sha'arim, what do you mean? I'm going to uproot all the gates so the city won't have gates? Hafkas Sha'arim. Hafkas Sha'arim, we're talking about this prohibition of excessive price fixing, of excessive profiteering. So this is actually, says the Gemara, this is what the bracha, the Megillah, Daf Yud Zayin, and Beis, Mara loma becha soshanim b'tshiyas, am Rabbi Aksanri, kenegin mafkiye shorim. This bracha barecha leinu es soshana hazo should be a blessed year, that all the prices should be fixed at the right amount, and that there should not be hoarding, and there should not be a price of manipulation, there should not be the price gouging of them, of the public. And the reason it was made as the ninth bracha is because the reference, the people who engage in this type of price gouging, is in the ninth kapitel Tehillim. The ninth kapitel Tehillim, of course, is different from Perek Tes. No, okay, I said kapitel. The ninth kapitel Tehillim is what we call Perek Yud, because really Perek Aleph and Perek Beis is one kapitel. So therefore, Perek Yud, what we refer to Perek Yud, so that is the ninth kapitel of Tehillim. And therefore, we make it in the ninth of bracha, because that parasha talks about, we say, Shavua Zera Zroa Rasha. that the arm, the strong arm of those gangsters who are gouging the public by charging prices for chayei nefesh that are too high, it should be broken. It should be broken. And we see that the pasuk, that the psukim are speaking about that because it says yerav b'mister ka'aye b'suko yerav l'achtov oni. The person is going is waiting an ambush in order to rob from the poor person. What kind of a stupid gangster is this that they're waiting in ambush to steal from the poor person? You're gonna pounce upon the poor person. You're not gonna end up with anything. They're poor. You're gonna take their wallet. There's nothing inside. There's nothing inside. There's a bunch of credit cards that are overcharged. And so you want $100,000 of credit card debt? Like, why are you ambushing the poor person? So explains Rashi. No. We're talking about mafkiyei sharim akasim midaber. People talking about people driving up the price for basic necessities. Who's going to get hurt? Those people who need the basic necessities, they can't afford it. The people who get hurt the most are the aniyim. So that's what this capital Tehillim is referring to. And then at the end, and then it says in that capital, v'rat tidrosh rishol bal timtza, that the person is going to try to do evil, but they won't succeed. They won't succeed because you know what? We're going to regulate the prices. We're not going to let them. We're going to set people on the right path. That's the beauty of it. The beauty of the price regulation that we're going to do is we're going to prevent people from being rishoyim. So we're going to actually help people by regulating their market behavior, remain on their best behavior and to remain on the right path. This is also, by the way, why we don't begin a series of fasts. We have a Bahav, we have a series of three fasts when there's a drought in the world, so you're supposed to fast Monday, Thursday, Monday. Why not Thursday, Monday, Thursday? Why not start a series of fasts out of Yom Chamishi? So says the Gemara, no, we wouldn't do that. Shalol hafkiya sharim, because then that's going to cause a price gouging. How is that in the world? Is that going to cause price gouging? Rashi explains, because of the shopkeepers who are not following the news, they didn't know that there was a series of fasts there that were declared. They're too busy trying to make money. So they see that there's going to be a mad rush on Thursday that people are buying so much because, number one, they need their food for Shabbos, for the Suda Shabbos. They're going to buy a lot. They're going to buy extra because people always like to have a big meal after a fast, right? This Friday night, oh, it's going to be a bigger meal than ever, right? Because after a fast, people want to have, you know, a giant meal. So they'll see they're buying up for two giant meals. They're buying up for a giant meal for Thursday night, and they're buying up for a giant meal for Shabbos. So they'll just see that people are buying so much, like the food is going it's going, you know, out of business. So they're going to think of that it's going, you know, that there's a major famine that is coming onto the world. And when they see that there's a major famine, so they figured, oh, Barav Liolam, so scarce supply, they're going to raise prices. Miyakri Mafki Mashar, they're going to therefore cause a price increase based on Behola, based on a sense of panic when they see that people are buying so much. So in order to prevent that sense of panic, that people are going to buy both for their Shabbos meal and for their Thursday night, my night meal at the same time, so we don't institute. I mean, obviously, if it's a public fast day, people knew about it. But we're not going to institute a new series of fasts that's going to begin on a Thursday for that reason. Now, there are a few provisos. Beyond the nature of the chayei nefesh prerequisite, which means that if I'm dealing with luxury items, then in terms of setting a price to begin with, you would be allowed, the merchants would be allowed to set a higher price and then just allow market forces to enable the price to come out to be whatever is going to be the most reasonable. And we're not going to worry about price manipulation on the market with respect to those things. There are a few other provisos as well. One is, and this is mentioned, if you look in source 3 in Tosfos, it talks about the Beitzim case and Baba Basra Daf Tzadi Aleph. Why was Beitzim different? Because there was a lot of tircha that went into collection of Beitzim. So that was one explanation as to why you can have more of a profit, because whatever was the cost of the Beitzim, you have to also factor in other tircha costs as well. If you're going with that approach, so whatever is going to be the margin, 1/6 profit or 100% profit, whatever's the profit that we're going to allow, we're going to factor in not only the cost of the item, but all of the necessary expenses as well. So that the merchant has lots of expenses, so that gets put into the principal amount equation that you would use as your base in order to figure out what is the 1/6 profit on chayei nefesh you would make from there. Number two, we allow, and if you look in the Torah, both the Torah and the Shulchan Aruch have all of these exceptions. The Torah in source 14 over here in Siman Reish Lamed Aleph, that says the Chanvani, who sells a little bit at a time and therefore has overhead in terms of his tirchah, so his yihotzos, the staff that he needs, the overhead that has, can be taken into account. And he also says, Bamedri Mamur, the second exception, Shalo Hukar Ashar, Aba Hukar Ashar Yimko Kafiya Yoker. Let's say that when this merchant adds up his expenses and the one and picks out his profit, so 1/6 would come out to a certain amount. Oh, he'd have to sell for $20. But the market says you could sell the oil for $25. So if the market price has already been set for $25, Judge Solomon, so then he has the right to sell according to the market price. He shouldn't be deprived from the market price. So because otherwise he's going to be driven out. So I had a question about this. I had an economic question about this because we talk about a predatory pricing. Yaruch HaShulchan talks about that. I don't know if we'll get around to it today. Maybe we will, maybe we won't. If we don't, so it's fine. So then I have Mara Mekomas for next time. Not so bad. But one of the things we say about predatory pricing is don't drive down the market, because if you're the one who's selling cheap, everybody's going to come to you. So I say, why should this guy who's able to make his 1/6 profit margin by selling at $20 and the market price is $25, why do we tell him to sell for $25? Let him sell for the $20. He's making a profit. Everybody's going to come to him. Everybody's going to come to him. So I asked Rabbi Rapp this question. He's a big economic expert. And he said, this is the concept of anchoring. Anchoring. Oh, I said, oh, you mean the guy's going to be an aguna? Oh, now I understand. I said, anchoring means like this. That when you go into a store and you see that there's Charmin toilet paper, or so you know that Charmin toilet paper, so it's really good quality. So they sell a certain amount, they sell for a certain price, and then you see that there's a store brand of a toilet paper which is selling for cheaper. The store brand is selling for cheaper, so are you going to buy the store brand? It's probably just as good as Charmin. Say, no. Because since Charmin already, they're charging a certain price, and you see like all the good brands are charging a certain price, you say, you know what, this other brand's probably not so good. Probably not so good. If I can afford to buy the higher, you know, to spend the higher price, I'm going to buy the store brand, because, you know, that's probably inferior quality. So if everybody's selling for a certain amount, and then you're selling for this lower amount, you're going to get this branding that because you weren't anchored at the higher amount, so people are going to go after the other brand. So let's say they make a sale. Charmin says, we're not going to sell $20. Oh, $5 sale. Nobody's buying your product. It's not on sale at all for $20. They're only going to buy the Charmin that's on sale that's selling for $20. They say they're on a sale because they anchored themselves at the market price at $25. So therefore, it looks much more attractive when you're spending the same amount of money, but you're getting a $5 discount buying Charmin than spending that amount of money for no discount with respect to your product. So that was sort of the argument that he explained as to why it would be detrimental to sell at the lower price under these circumstances. So I like that explanation, so I'm just giving it. Number three, the third, yes. Zachlatot, we're going to get to the Zachlatot. It's a question whether the Aruch HaShulchan is correct with respect to the prohibition against predatory pricing, because it's a machlokes at Bava Metzia, Daf Samach and Aleph, between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim, as to whether a person can sell, you know, for a lower price and say to the other person, hey, or are they giving a special benefit or bonus? Is I'm distributing klayos, you can distribute a gozim. And therefore there's nothing wrong with selling lower. And we say, Zachlatot, that the Shita of the Chach, that the Chachamim say a person who does that, he should be remembered for good. And if the Aruch HaShulchan says, yeah, that's if the market can support it. If the market can, if by using market forces, you can enable, you can be more efficient and you could sell for less, and then you're allowed to. But if it's something which really nobody could do, and even you yourself couldn't do it, or you're just willing to suffer a loss in order to drive the other person out from the market altogether, so then that would be usher. And there's the whole pun in Miros, and as I said, that's a separate discussion which I could get into now, but I'm trying to just go in order. Okay, so again, the third exception, which is mentioned by the Rama, the Torah has this, is Hani Mili Hecha Deika Beidina, the Parshi Lekula Mokwen, the Zvunei Achi. Remember what we said, that in order to establish the proper market price and to prevent the merchants from artificially inflating the market prices, so you need to have a supervision of the Beis Din. But let's say there is no Beis Din available, or the Beis Din is simply not doing its job. They're too busy dealing with all of their other issues, Guna cases and Geiris, they have the Dinei Torah. They have time for this. They didn't get around to it. They say there's no Beis Din to do it. So every single person is just charging whatever it is they can get away with. So then you're not entitled, you're not deprived under those circumstances from engaging in the same type of a free market competition as everybody else. And the Beis Yosef says that this is really hinted at by the Rambam, because the Rambam makes this halacha sort of one dependent upon the other. Because the Rambam says that about Beis Din, Chayovim Lifsok Asharim Lahamid Shotrin Lakach, that it's the Beis Din that has this obligation to supervise the markets, indicating that if you do supervise the prices, and if you don't have the Beis Din available to supervise the prices, so then it's not an automatic thing that everybody basically has to follow under those circumstances. Is that this becomes essentially how the Shulchan Aruch expresses it the same way. Chayavim Beis Din La'amin Mamunim Al Hashem Shlo Yaviyo Kolechan Mashiyirtze. It becomes a Beis Din obligation. She'ein lo La'odam La'aviyach B'dvarim She'esh B'em Chayin Nefesh. Because a person should not make that a profit of more than 1/6. So therefore, Beis Din has to establish the price. If Beis Din didn't establish the price, so then this would not end up being the halacha. And it's kind of interesting because somewhere along the way, sort of this regulatory authority and the idea that you can't make more than the 1/6 of the profit in terms of the market price, they sort of were joined together at the hip. You look in the Gemara, there's one thing about Beis Din regulating prices. Another thing about Amar Shmuel, Hamistakir Ayistakir Yotir Mishtus, it was not joined at the hip that one is dependent upon the other. But at a certain point, the codifiers of the halacha came to the conclusion that really one became dependent upon the others. And it became not just a below yaviach, that a person should not make more than a sixth of profit, right? But it became shelo yaviach, that you need to have the Beis Din there in order shelo yaviach, so that there will not be this excessive profit. But it's only if you have really the Beis Din available to do their thing and to exercise their authority. Okay, so what if you don't have a Beis Din that's available, or people aren't listening to the Beis Din? So the Shevet Alevi points out, if you look in a source, one second. The Shevet Alevi points out that when is it that we sort of work with the assumption that if there's no Beis Din around, so then we have to leave things on the wayside, or we have to just put up our hands in exasperation? That is basically when you have a market where there are non-Jewish merchants who are driving up the prices. But he says that if I am dealing with a market where I have Yirei Elokim, and there are mochrim who are Yisraelim, the other sellers are not non-Jews, who are miyakrim ashar, who are lo tzaisi the beidina, but the Yisraelim, then aleihem lishmor ledas Torah, v'im lo tzaisi oy lehem ezervavo, v'alaseinu rabim kamen lo mistagim ezav piyolach apilu tovim shebanu. He says, we're not allowed to just kind of despair and give up. If we have Jews in the community or not listening to the Beis Din, the community has an obligation to implement enforcement mechanisms so that people will pay attention to the Beis Din. There's no right to say, oh, people aren't going to listen to us anyway. That's only if they're not listening because they're not under our jurisdiction. But if they are under our jurisdiction, so then we have an obligation to regulate them. The Aruch HaShulchan, source 24, Simon Reish Lamed Aleph Sifka Chofe basically says the same thing. He says that these rules only apply when you have a Beis Din that is available in order to enforce their rules or in order to command the proper market prices. If you can't, however, have any impact upon the others, so it's not fair if nobody else is listening for only those people who are very righteous to listen to the Beis Din. But then the Aruch HaShulchan adds a line. He says, "Umiu im a Beis Din yodim shayidei ze yuchlaku gam achayim mikor kamoim yachliko la shomim." But if they know that by having a few good role models, in the city who are going to show that they are following the Bezdin, and then they're going to set an example that other people are going to follow them. We would hope that we have communities that work this way. So then you're not allowed to just throw your hands up in the air and to despair, but you have to enforce the authority as much as possible. If for whatever reason the Bezdin is not able to do it, so then halacha has all kinds of different mechanisms for basically other people to step into the breach. And we have the idea of takanas b'nei ha'ir and the takanas b'nei ha'umnus. We have this idea that's expressed in the Gemara in Baba Basra, Daf Ches Amud Beis, and Tes Amud Aleph, and the Tosefta in Baba Metzia, that talk about basically the right in Baba Metzia, Perakit Aleph, they talk about the ability and the right of the B'nai Ha'ir to be Messiah al-Kitzoson, to make all kinds of takanos with respect to Havkash Sha'arim, with respect to prices, with respect to what's considered to be appropriate minimum prices. When you have Umnin who are gathering together and they have to figure out how they're going to make ends meet and what's going to be a minimum profit at which they'll be able to make a living, what should you pay the workers, and how they're going to conduct their trade amongst themselves, and also a takanas of b'nei, and also we say lahasnos ala sha'arim alamidos. You look at the Tosefta in Baba Metzia, which is also born in the Gemara in Baba Basra, Daf Ches Amud Beis. So basically, this function then is taken over by the regulatory authorities, by the people of the city and their governmentally elected representatives. If they don't have governmentally elected representatives, they could do it themselves. And basically, this is another way in which this power can be exercised. The problem is, particularly when you have merchants that are setting prices upon them by themselves, sometimes that could kind of go in the wrong direction. If they're not so God-fearing, you can have cartels that are going to establish extremely high prices. So that's why the Gemara says, if you have an Adam Chashuv in the year, you have a Talmid Chacham who has an understanding basically of how to regulate business within the city. Has to be a person who's both a chacham, he's both an adam chashuv, and he also understands the finance. So then you're obligated to bring that individual into the picture. The Sma quotes a machlokis between the Rosh and the other on the one hand, and the Maram Ashikar on the other. On the other hand, he quotes it, the machlokis between the tour and Maram al-Shikar. I think the Rosh also holds like the first Shita, as to whether this requirement of an Adam Chashuv is only when you're dealing with takanas that are made by different industries, by the industry members, like all of the Shochtim make a certain takana, as the Gemara talks about, or even when it's B'nai Ayir. When it's the B'nai Ayir, so it could be that the B'nai Ayir, that the people, what is the function of Bezdin? That's to act on behalf of all the people of the city. So if all the people of the city get together, so that could be, according to Maram al-Shikar, that could be good enough, to be a substitute for this idea of Adam Chashuv. Adam Chashuv is only when I don't have something which is functioning like a Bezdin, but the entire B'nai Ayir really is functioning like a Bezdin. So that's a possibility that you can simply, that the Bezdin really is exercising a governmental authority, but that can be exercised by B'nai Ayir as well. It can even be exercised by trades of people and trade unions within a particular industry. But then there's an Adam Chashuv requirement, provided that you have an Adam Chashuv. You don't have an Adam Chashuv, so then you might be in trouble. That might not necessarily just mean that everything is fine, but you just might be in trouble. So Rav Henkin, when he writes in his Tshuvas Ibra and Simon Sadi Bob, so I think there's a typo, just says Simon Sadi, but Sadi Bob in the Tshuvas Ibra. So Rav Henkin has this idea as well, that if we live in a society for whatever reason that the Bezdin is not equipped to make takanos, so you know who ends up being the B'nai Ayir. You live in a democratic society, we have elected officials, so then it's expected that the takanos that are going to be for the welfare of society in terms of price regulation and the like, or rent control regulation, things of that variety, are going to be the hands of the government, and those should be respected. You had a case that came to Bezdin. Bezdin should respect that, because it basically was Bezdin's job, just that Bezdin couldn't do it. So they have to defer to the B'nai Ayir. Who's the B'nai Ayir? The B'nai Ayir end up being duly elected officials of the year. So they make these types of takanas on behalf of society. So then that becomes the equivalent of essentially the Bezdin's regulatory function. So of course, that would be something that Bezdin would respect as well. The whole idea of the B'nai Ayir, the Rishonim discussed, the Mordechai, in Baba Basra and the Simon Tafei, he says that the whole authority of the Bnei Ha'ir really comes from this concept of Bezdin, that Hefker Bezdin Hefker. Others say that it comes from Tnai Shema Mammon or Shutvin, but the basic understanding is, I think, that of the Mordechai, that this authority comes anyway from Hefker Bezdin Hefker. So Dr. Warhafstig, in his article in the first issue of Tehumen, he also says that nowadays regulatory agencies and consumer protection boards and the like end up playing this role to some degree. Shlomo Zalman Orbach in the Mincha Shlomo in Chelek Aleph Siman Pei Zayin has this in connection with teachers' unions, where he says that when, if you're looking for a Chacham Ha'ir, when it comes to teachers' unions, Bnei Ha'umnos who are making takanas, are going to go on strike, not go on strike, whatever, he says we don't really have Talmidei Chachamim who play this role anymore of Adam Chashuv to be consulted with. So then they can basically do their thing. But he says at the end of the day that you should find like a gadol anyway and consult with the gadol before you make your final decision. Rabbi Yehuda Zolden, who's one of the contemporary Dayanim, also speaks at these annual Dayanos conferences that I attend. So Rabbi Yehuda Zolden is a very, very smart, practical, down-to-earth, hands-on Dayan. So he writes that Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach only required seeking out a Talmid Chacham when it came to a teacher's strike, which is going to lead to Bittul Torah. But if it's not something that's going to lead to Bittul Torah, you don't have an Adam Chashuv. So then basically, he says that the unions and the regulatory agencies and all of those mechanisms today serve in place of the role that originally was supposed to be assumed by Bezdin when it comes to these issues. Now, when you do have the Bnei Ha'ir, or you have the Bnei Umnos who comes together, so then there's a separate sidebar question as to whether you need everybody. Because you require, you know, that everybody has to agree, or do you need the majority? So this is kind of like a little bit, you know, difficult to understand how you could have a requirement for everybody, because that's not going to work. You're never going to have everybody to agree. So the one who says that very clearly is the Rosh and Klal Bava, and Tshuva Hei, says it has to be the majority. Timlon came, lo li olam lo yaskimo kahalo shum dover, because nobody will ever agree on anything. That's why the Torah says, Achrei Rabim Matos. So the Aruch HaShulchan in this Siman Reish Lamanav, I don't want you to think that I'm getting, you know, off a base or anything. The Aruch HaShulchan basically accepts that sheet. He says, really, Elu V'Elu. You only need a majority, but you need a majority. Like we speak about Shiva Tuvei HaKahal, Shiva Tuvei Ha'ir, B'Mamad Kol Anshei Ha'ir. So he says that's the idea, that you have to invite everybody to participate. Everybody has to be invited to have a vote. Everybody has to be invited to come to the town hall meeting. But as long as everybody is invited, everybody gets a vote. So, of course, it ends up being decided by the majority. Some say that's the meaning when the Gemara says in the Sefer talks about Lahasiya al Kitzoson. Lahasiya al Kitzoson is interpreted in two different ways in terms of the communal authority. One is that you have the ability to issue a penalty. That's one understanding of Kitzoson. And the other is Kitzoson means that you have the ability, the majority has the ability to force the minority. That's what it really means. Unless it's something which is patently unfair, but it's something which is essentially a price regulation, that's not something which is apparently unfair. So now, an important exception that's mentioned by the Ran in the name of the Rimi Gush to the Chacham Ha'ir requirement, when you would have a Chacham Ha'ir requirement, is when there's no hefsek, when it's just a question that you have a certain industry that's making ridiculous profits, and you say, instead of making ridiculous profits, make more reasonable profits that everybody will be able to afford, but you'll still end up way ahead. So there's no hefsed. It's not rav chalai, the hefsed lai. So then you don't need a chacham here in that case. So that's the Sholem Meshiv is a great case study. Sholem Meshiv, I only gave you a tiny little bit of it in source 22 in Madura Kinyana Chelek Dal Siman Pei Tes. This is when the butchers all decided to sell meat for a ridiculously high price. And the question came to the Sholem Meshiv as to whether all the people of the city came together, or a majority, they came together, Rominion, he says, came together and said that we're not going to allow people to buy the meat unless the prices are going to be lowered. Is that this something which is binding? Because the Rav Ha'ir would not go along with it. The reason the Rav Ha'ir wouldn't go along with it is because he was on the payroll of the butchers. Since he was on the payroll of the butchers, therefore he was a Nogei B'Dover. So says the Sholem Meshiv, this is considered to be a binding takana for three reasons. Number one, it's the Bnei Ha'ir, and you have the Shita of the Maram Al Shikur that says you don't need an Adam Chashuv when it's a takana of the Bnei Ha'ir. Number two, there's no Adam Chashuv over here because the Rav has been disqualified. And number three, you don't need an Adam Chashuv anyway because there's no hefsed. It's Rav Kalai, Rav Kalai. Everybody's doing okay. Everybody's coming out good. The consumers are getting their meat, and the butchers are making a profit. They're just not making an exorbitant, ridiculous profit. So this was a good case study illustration of how all of these different potential exceptions come into play. When we talk about, however, whether it's the Bezdin that's making these regulations, whether it ends up being a regulatory authority, like Rav Shlomo Zalman indicates, or in Rav Yehuda Zolden and Tamar Wahafter, many of the contemporary authors, Rav Hink, and so forth. So the question also becomes then, in terms of what it is that we need to regulate. How do we define chayei nefesh nowadays? So if Haigon says it's basically anything which everybody needs, whatever it is that everybody needs. So it's not necessarily restricted to foodstuffs. So though in the Gemara talks about the yedim shmanim muslasos, but it really could be beyond that. So Dr. Wahaftig suggests that at least in the intermediate category of eggs, maybe you allow more than a 1/6 profit, but not through the roof, not more than a 100% profit, would be basic household appliances, basic clothing, ritual items, and even housing. But Shlomo Ishon, who's a dayan in Eretz Yisrael, in Chelek Yud Gimel of the Shaarei Tzedek, which we need to update because I think we only have until Chelek Yud or something like that. But now there are 23 volumes, so you should really, you know, get the remaining volumes. And a lot of really good articles, by the way, in, I have to say, in the last number of volumes that I can vouch for. That Rav Shlomo Ishon thinks that chayei nefesh nowadays, actual chayei nefesh, would include milk, formula, basic fruits and vegetables, meat and fish, and schooling, tuition that shouldn't go through the roof, in addition to at least housing in Eretz Yisrael. He points out that according to the Ran, every Jew has a chelek in the real estate in Eretz Yisrael, right? That's why the Ran says, Dina de Machusa, Dina doesn't apply. He says, oh, okay, maybe Dina de Machusa applies. But in terms of the basic argument in the Ran, that everybody has a right to affordable housing in Eretz Yisrael. So he says that also is something which should be subject to regulation. And this becomes particularly relevant to Shnas Petzoris considerations and both of the prohibition during Shnas Petzoris against both hoarding and price gouging. Because Rav Ezer Bassi points out that it's not only during years of famine, but it could be during any time of year national emergency. Like, for example, during wartime. If you look at Rav Ezer Bassi, source 18, Ha'ara 10, it says, Yesh lomo mizeh, from this prohibition of hoarding during a year of famine, she'advarim kavachomer. She'mishnas betzoras, afidu kama she'godu lodem misedeo asur le'etzo yotem mishana, alachas kama v'kama be'is mechoma, she'osel nisnapil alashukim le'etzor, alashvachim le'etzor mikol ababi yad, lahaknis mumah v'hola betzibor. If it's a time of war, how much more careful you have to be. It's like a time of famine when you basically have a time of desperation, of a limited supplies and like of a fear of limited supplies. And so he says that we find the yedios uvdos, if yeduos uvdos, she'anoshim yisnaplo alechem b'cholav, we know of cases where people took advantage of national emergencies to drive up the prices of bread and milk, yoysem e'atzorech, ve'achakak shavku v'zarku. And the people who basically hoarded these items as well, where they had stockpiles of these items so during times of war, times of panic, and they ended up malu beisam yosim yatzarach. Then they had to throw out the excess items, and then there were some people who didn't have any. And we know that this occurred definitely during Corona. Corona people were stockpiling items to a degree where they were just, you know, terrified. At the beginning of the pandemic, they would take loads and loads of toilet paper and other types of basic items, Lysol, Purell, whatever it happened to be, and it wasn't available. Face masks wasn't available. That became chayei nefesh. Boy, that became chayei nefesh. It wasn't available for other people in the marketplace. So I heard Moshe Taragin gave a shiur at the beginning of the coronavirus where he said that he remembered a fiery sermon, fiery musishmuz, that was given by Rav Alan Lichtenstein in the late 80s, early 90s, when there was a post office shortage, that this wasn't even chayei nefesh. Maybe it was at the time of asimonim. Oh, there were no asimonim anymore available, and that was the only way you could make telephone calls. And this is the dark ages, right? People can't relate. This is when dinosaurs roamed the earth, whatever. Used to be that you could only make telephone calls with asimonim. They ran out of asimonim in the post office, and there was some tamidim who apparently like gathered up like the entire market of asimonim that had for themselves. He heard about this. And he said, you're taking it off the market, you're depriving all of these other people. And he gave a fiery, fiery musash muzaban and kavachomer, beminosha kavachomer. We are dealing with necessary life-saving items during a pandemic. So not only was there price gouging during the pandemic, but there were all kinds of other types of abuses with respect to merchants driving up prices during the pandemic. There was according to research that was done in an article that I read by Heshi Friedman and Murray Mizrahi in a Journal of Rules-Based Leadership in 2021. So they pointed out that there was one point in time in which a package of 320 Lysol disinfecting wipes that typically sold for an average of $13.50 came to be $220. Purell sanitizer that normally sold for $7.99 was being sold for as much as $49.95. And Amazon, at the time, had to shut down over 500,000 products and suspend more than 6,000 vendors because of price gouging during this time. So these halakhas are very, very relevant. Even ad hayom hazeh, very, very relevant, especially when you speak about something which is akin to shnas betzoris, and when you are dealing with items, look, face masks are probably not chayei nefesh, like carbs, when you're dealing with shnas hasova, but when you're dealing with a health crisis like a pandemic, so then that becomes chayei nefesh, and it would be prohibited to hoard those items, and certainly to gouge prices with respect to these types of items. And in fact, the Amazon published a notice in which they spoke about with disappointed that bad actors are attempting to take advantage of this global health crisis. In addition to removing these offers, we are terminating accounts and working directly with state's attorney generals to prosecute bad actors and hold them accountable. And it really is, even according to halacha, it's a punishable offense. The halacha in Shulchan Aruch speaks about kol mafkiyah sharim, shemoichem yosem me'aroyim. We say v'shayim al koso li'anshok if yaroy. That you can actually give people malchus. So these do become criminal offenses, and this is something which we have a responsibility, either through the Bezdin or through deferring to the regulatory authorities, we have a responsibility to regulate under these circumstances. Now, the next thing that I wanted to discuss, I guess I'll spend 5 minutes on this and then we'll end, is the regulation of prices with respect to mitzvah items. To what degree are mitzvah items considered to be chayei nefesh? Dr. Wapik said ritual items are also something that people basically need. And one of the authors, it may have been Dr. Wapik, I don't remember if it was him or Dr. Rakov, wrote an article. One of them quoted from a Teferes Yisrael in Bechoras Perek Dal at Aloch above, who says, "Ein roi v'chachbid al abrios yosef midai b'chol yonikim haTorah v'mitzvah." Any ritual item, it's not right to overly oppress the people in terms of the prices that are charged. Shehu tachlis kol abriya, because Torah mitzvos, you know, ein lecha chayei nefesh gedoy lemizu, it's tachlis kol abriya. That's very, very strong. I thought you're looking for a marker for this idea. That's like a pretty good marker. Because we do find a lot of price regulation in this regard. There's the famous case of the Tzemach Tzedek that everybody knows about, of course. The Tzemach Tzedek talks about where there was an overpricing in a particular, in his area, he was in Nicholsburg, he was a Nicholsburg rub in the 1600s, so Menachem Mendel Krachmal, and the people of a nearby town wanted to, the Bnei Ayir made a takana. The question was, is this a proper takana not to buy fish, because there was price gouging with respect to the fish, but the fish was needed for Shabbos. So the question was, but what about the mitzvah of owning Shabbos? And what about the promise that all a person's hotzos are all accounted for in Rosh Hashanah, other than what they pay for Shabbos and Yontem? So therefore, whatever is going, this is a great deal for the merchants. They can say, we can charge $1 million. Don't worry, it won't be taken off your cheshbon. So the question was whether this was an appropriate takana. And of course, he quoted the Mishnah at the end of the first parak of Krisus. It says that Rav Shimon Gamliel made a takana. We saw that the kinim, that the pairs of birds that women who gave birth were obligated to bring in order to eat and catch him. When it went through the roof, when it was funny being charged for 25 times more than it should have been charged for, a dina zav instead of a dina kesef. So he said that I'm not allowing, that I'm going to make the din that a woman is only, if she gave birth 5 times, she only has to bring one set of kinim, she only has to bring one set of kabanos, and the rest of it is not going to, the way the girsa that we have, the rest of it is not going to be a chova for her to bring. Even though normally she could eat kachim after she bought one set, but she'd have to bring all the other sets. It's not going to be a chova for her to bring all the other sets. That's the way Rashi learns. He says, "Eis lasus l'shem eferu Torah secha." As a result, the women were happy, but the merchants were devastated because it meant that the women weren't going to buy the birds altogether except for one pair. So therefore, that drove down the prices. So, and of course, Rabbeinu Tam says that wasn't exactly it. They still were obligated to bring afterwards, like the Ikara din was, the Ashar was still a chobra for everybody. So he has a different understanding of the Takana that he just broadcast, that they'd be allowed to do this. But according to Rashi, he actually changed the din from requiring the other kinim to saying you're not required. He didn't say that they'd be allowed to eat a kachim betuma, but this was in order to prevent them from eating kachim betuma, because if they just bought one set, that would miyikar din be good enough for them to eat the kachim afterwards. So he says, by the same token, I'm sorry.
Just curious, based on what you're talking about, I
can't hear. I'm sorry. You're breaking up. You're breaking up. Is there any? Yeah, we can't hear you. We can't hear you. If you want to, like, maybe text.
Can you hear me now? Or?
Oh, yeah. Now we can hear you. Now we can hear you.
Okay. Yeah. No. I just want to ask you, like contemporary. Like, I mean, how does it work compared to fine nefesh, right? Because you're saying fine nefesh is like basic items, right? But like, on the other hand, like, you know, the kind of Jewish culture aspect of it that we need it, right? So like two things I've been thinking about. One is like women's clothes, and then one is supermarkets, right? Because the obviously you can buy clothes, but like clothes in Jewish owned Mies boutiques tend to be extremely expensive, right?
This is true.
Supermarkets, you can buy food, right, in a non-Jewish supermarket, like that, but the price is, you know, the trend in Jewish supermarkets has been to make them luxury supermarkets or whatever, you know, like, so I'm curious if there's any role for base in either of those, because it's not really high nefesh, right? On the other hand, it's kind of changing the culture so that the culture becomes everyone, you know, that's like the norm and then people can't afford it.
Okay.
You know, like you're saying about the keynote,
I'll give you the short answer. If you can have something which is basically in a luxury item category, and a person who pays that price is not going to drive up the price for those items that are not quite on the same luxury level, so then that would be okay. But if it's going to end up driving the prices for everybody else, even with respect to items that are not really luxury items, so then it would be problematic if it's in a mitzvah category. So the Magen Avraham in Siman Tov Reish Nun Vav at the very beginning says a person can pay an exorbitant price for a very, very mehudar esrog. But if as a result of his paying that exorbitant price for the very mehudar esrog is going to drive up the price of all the other esrogim for everybody else who just wants sort of the simple, okay, they can't afford more than the simple esrogim, so then it would be prohibited for that person to pay that price in the first instance because it's going to end up driving up the price of all the other esrogim. So we see how these types of considerations are very much taken into account by the poskim. So the Tzemach Tzedek in this case said that it was the professor who said that there's no mitzvah that you have to have dafka dogim. Secondly, with respect to the segula of whatever you pay, that's only for a person who basically has mamono matzoi, as the resources available in the first place. Otherwise, we say, so therefore, he felt that this was appropriate. Even the Tzemach Tzedek got pushback, but his shita was accepted by the Magen Avraham, his shita was accepted by the Mishnah Berurah. The Mishnah Berurah actually codifies this shita of the Tzemach Tzedek. The many other takanas that were made along these lines, especially with respect to esrogim, you find in the Mabit, you find the Takanov that was signed by Yitzchak Kochanan in 1875, telling people, okay, so we're not going to buy the esrogim, or at least, you know, the fancy mehudar esrogim, unless you drive down the prices, and we're going to tell people they can be satisfied with the basic halacha, whatever it would be. Therefore, you do find that there were a lot of takanas in this regard. And I think it runs to the issue that if it's going to be a question of a non-fulfillment of the basic mitzvah, or even taking away the ability to have a basic level of owning Shabbos, so then it's appropriate to put a certain takanos in place to drive down the prices in the marketplace so that there not be a price gouging with respect, yes, to what people consider to be high nefesh, with respect to the women's apparel example. So Pakshi Doron, in an article that he wrote, he points out that in Frankfurt they had a takana that was made that you're not allowed to price women's clothing above a certain amount. Whatever was considered to be the norm of women's clothing that everybody bought, it had to be at a certain price. You're not obligated to walk around in tattered clothing or whatever. So it was a basic level of respectable clothing. It was being overpriced. It said you're not allowed to price it above a certain amount. And this is what goes into all of the takanas having to do with not overpricing weddings and the things that are sort of basic necessities, including housing in the Jewish community. These are areas where, including schooling and tuition in our community, these are areas where we need to have proper regulatory authorities and measures that are put into place. If it's something which we can't do through the government, we have to do it through the Bezdin. We have to do it through community resources and authorities and groups to get together. We see that this is part of what the halakha actually requires. So again, I did not get into the whole sugya about whether we allow. I did get into it a little bit as I was talking about how I'm not going to get into it about predatory pricing. So the bottom line is, with respect to predatory pricing, is that essentially we subscribe to the Aruch HaShulchan's principle, which is that we paskin like the Chachamim, Neged Rabbi Yehuda, that if the market is able to bear through efficiencies and the like, the ability to price a product lower or to make a superior product, like the Panim Eros, you know, talks about, you may make a superior beer. So you figured out how to make a superior beer. Somebody else can figure out how to make a superior beer where they won't have to charge as much, and your beer is going to be more attractive. So that's perfectly fine. But if you are artificially going to decrease prices to a degree that you couldn't even support yourself, it's just that you have extra resources. You could suffer a loss of 5 months in order to drive somebody else out of business. So that's what the Aruch HaShulchan says, both in the Siman Shin Chuk Zayin, I think, and also in Siman Shin Lamed Aleph. He says that would be prohibited, and I think that we generally work with that assumption. It's an interesting sidebar discussion between Rabbi Aaron Levine points out that what if you have a competitor in the market who says, I'm just going to give out things for free, because I have, like, I love people so much, everyone's going to get free hot dogs. And he's driving, like, all the hot dog vendors out of business. So he says that if you're not looking to make a profit, basically, so then there is no free market model, you know, in halacha, where you're just giving things out. So then that would be prohibited. The Pisvei Choshen in Hilchos Geneva and Perek Yudalet, Halacha Yudalet, he says, what's so bad about freebies if the freebies are just being given on a limited, you know, market basis, like for some people who qualify? So I think that the distinction there is, are you talking about like a limited population of people who are below a certain income level? You're giving out like free meat to them for Pesach, Moschitim, things of that variety. So that's considered to be tzedakah. That's considered to be a good thing. But if you're making it available for everybody, because you're such a generous person and therefore you're driving the merchants out of business, that might be more problematic. Unless we're dealing with like pikuach nefesh. It's a really hot day and somebody's giving out free water bottles. Oh, so the vendors who are on the side of the street, who are on the side of, you know, the really, you know, hot scorching streets, that were making a lot of money selling the water bottles, they're not going to be able to make as much money. So I hope pikuach nefesh is different. I know that's a mystery. You're giving out free water bottles. I went to the march in Washington. And I came out, so there was somebody giving out, what, 300,000 people there, but they had water bottles to everybody. So maybe an enterprising, you know, person would have had, you know, would have been selling water bottles. I don't think it's an issue to take away their business. It's a mitzvah. You know, people out there, you know, for a long time, they're thirsty, they're standing for a long time, giving them water bottles. It all depends on the context. So I'm not going to go into anything else, but we covered most of the territory. I have a few sources here about the importance of having minimum prices for workers. That we have to make sure that that there be living wages for people who are working, particularly if they're working for the Jewish community, there should be a certain threshold so people be able to support their families. They're in Rabbanus, they're in Chinuch. That's also, you know, part of when we speak about Mafkirin, when we speak about the idea of Mefakin Al HaShe'arim, that's also a part of the responsibility of Havkah Sha'arim, that there not be a chiseling of workers, that they should get paid the proper living wage. And just the last comment that I'll make is that I became interested a little bit in this topic. It wasn't just because we're doing, you know, this particular subject this year, and I was trying to figure out something that, you know, might be so boring and nobody else would dream of talking about it. But a friend of mine, who used to be my chavusa in my law firm, and also when I lived in Riverdale for a period of time, so he was speaking about this topic in his shul, Shavuos night, a couple of years ago, 2.5 years ago, and he asked me the question. He said, why is it that nobody speaks about this topic at all? Like, is it important halacha, and he doesn't find that people are paying any attention to it? So I started looking into it, you know, at that point in time, and I feel that, you know, it's not just a problem of Havkah Sha'arim, but it's a problem of Havkah Shiurim on Havkah Sha'arim. We don't have enough Shiurim on this particular topic, so I feel that this is, you know, an important, you know, fundamental issue about how important the price regulation is within our community, that we put an end to things like hoarding and price gouging, particularly during times of crisis, and that we address these issues and the need for regulation of these issues in appropriate halakhic fashion. And hopefully we've been able to remedy that somewhat in today's year. Yeah. Okay.